Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hey everyone, my name is Dmitry Karpov. I am Chief Product Officer and co-founder of Electronic Robotics, Austin-based company that does automation and does it affordably and accessibly to software users across the world.
Dmitry, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. I'm very excited about this conversation. We've been trying to plan this for quite some time. So before we dive in and talk about all the great things you guys are currently building at Electronic, maybe give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Sure, we'll do. So I'm originally a physicist focused on laser optics and quantum electronics. I came to the States around 15 years ago to do my PhD and to build lasers. But my career trajectory changed dramatically after I took a couple of classes on entrepreneurship in college. And thanks Microsoft, who sponsored my education there. It was really great experience to transition into the technology world. I went for MBA at Georgetown University, and later I joined a company called Ernst & Young, and over time became one of their leaders for early stage innovation, and that's how I get exposure to many exciting automation technologies in applications to real business environment. And around 2019, I embarked on a journey to start my own company with a couple of my co-founders who know the problem that we are addressing, the affordability of automation, really well. And I left big corporation. I left San Francisco to take this challenge. And so far, so good.
Well, that's quite a background you have, actually, starting with lasers. And now you guys are building software automation for enterprise and large corporations. I'm curious to maybe take us back to the early days of the current company you guys are building. What was the catalyst, or what were some of the motivating factors that really stood out to you, that really motivated you to go and partner up with your current co-founders and build Electronic?
Yeah. The first part of the story is my personal. I got very convinced in automation replacing repetitive labor in office setting specifically. I got this conviction from pretty much seeing the impact that automation like RPA, robotic process automation, made at EY. Ernst & Young was a collection of global firms, a lot of complex financial relationships, a lot of inter-firm transactions. A lot of people were supporting this financial infrastructure for global partnership to operate together. And we started to create bots to do these transactions. And bots that need, they need access to financial systems. And by the policy, if you need access to financial systems, you need to have an HR record for that. You need to create an account for you in all the systems. And over time, we implemented so many bots that there was a question of how many real employees are in the company, because there were more people in HR systems than people on the payroll. So who are these 5,000 people, let's say, who don't receive salary? Oh, these are software robots just pretending to be humans from software perspective. They mimic human actions. I lived in New York at the time. I took a subway ride thinking about like what I've just learned in terms of like business complexity of understanding how many people you have employed, because from HR records, they are not different from robots. And at the same time, I shared some of my kind of early excitements a year ago, maybe before that, with my friend Sergey, who was an implementation partner for one of the pioneers in RPA, UiPath, big enterprise company now. And he generated demand for services himself, essentially doing marketing. And he received inbound requests. And by that moment, he had experience of implementing the technology for big banks, for telecom companies, for really big companies. And I had experience of doing the same for, let's say, Bank of America and that type of size of clients in the States. And he tells me that in his marketing, he receives inbound leads that are smaller companies. And when he looks at current software stack that he needs to propose them, he understands that the budget would never be there. These companies cannot afford automation. But at the same time, processes in these, say, mid-size, sometimes small companies were not different from enterprise processes. Repetitive actions, not integrated software stack, legacy software stack. You need to put automation layer on top of that. And he got the idea, okay, let's build a software vendor, which is very different from being an implementation partner of a software vendor. That's how it all started, pretty much. And then Y Combinator came in as second chapter of the story. It gave us a lot of exposure to our financial partners, our investors in the future. And they believed in our idea that you can make automation tools simpler. You can make the business model easier for small companies. And over time, we started to what's called like hockey stick growth. And then another part of the journey, COVID came, and COVID killed that hockey stick growth very quickly because people stopped to, you know, picking up the phones. There was a different agenda in the world than just automation software. And it made us really think about the customer base we have and identify their subsegments that were really growing better and then we were still able to talk, like who's still buying from us. And we build our next hockey stick growth on this idea that we will focus on specific segment called IT service providers. In the United States, they're called managed service providers. In many countries, they will be called system integrators. They're a bit different from country to country, but usually these people, they do IT service for their clients, and they were the missing ingredient in using the automation tools. Essentially, if you try to sell a tool like ours to a small bank, that small bank at least need to have IT team who's going to build the automation. And we indeed will go to a service provider who works with this bank and sell to them so they can build a service of automating processes for their clients. The next chapter in that was to figure out that these people service providers also automate internally a lot, and building the whole kind of product approach to implementing automations quicker. There are many technology tools that I want to talk about, but we're entering a new chapter of our business when we introduced AI so much in the development process that it became much easier to build bots, even for very junior IT talent. Mm-hmm. And this enables us to now work directly with some of the clients, enterprises, mid-sized companies that want to turn their IT workforce into automation workforce. And I would be happy to focus on any of these in greater detail, but that's the journey of a technology company that is not a linear path. It's, you know, yeah, go right here, always trying to find what customers want the most and where these customers are.
Yeah. No, that's a very exciting journey. Thank you for sharing that. And as a VC, I spend a great deal of time talking to founders at the very, very early stages where it's just an idea on a napkin, where it's just very early, maybe even sometimes pre-MVP stages. And one of the topics that's ongoing conversation with a lot of founders, those early days where you're really trying to find that product market fit with some type of a GTM that you will have to pivot, you know, 8 times out of 10. Maybe take us back to those early days, maybe even pre-Y Combinator, where you guys were still trying to find that very initial product market fit. How did you guys go about this? Maybe share some of the experiments that you guys actually ran to be able to gauge that interest, especially when you deal with, you know, such a complex solution, you know, automation that geared towards, you know, the enterprise. Curious to get some of the examples from those days.
Thank you for pushing me back in memory to the awesome times. when you don't have a product.
Right.
I mean, I lead the product and I love it a lot. But when you don't have a product and you're building one, that's even more exciting because you're pretty much, you need to use different ways to experiment rather than having a product and being able to sell it. So my first advice to anyone in this, specifically in B2B context, I'm not a professional in B2C by any means. We like to talk with my co-founders a lot about this is so different area from B2B. Like I didn't understand it in the past. Now I know it's very different. So if you're in B2B, you need to experiment through sales and through sales only. Like feedback that users give you, showing, looking at something, is on, you can rely on that only very, very early. Then you need to start selling. So what is automation product? It's something, it's a software that runs on top of other software, doing something that otherwise will be done by either a user or someone who will write a script, or let's say developer, those who can automate with code, which is like the art. And you, when you sell automation, you know, people buy, of course, the way how you build automation. But in the end of the day, what creates economic value is this gain of not doing things repetitively or automating cheaper. So essentially, the first product was a black screen with a couple of green blocks that represent the process. It was doing something very, very technical. But showing that and saying, look at this, this is not something that like we're going to scale as is, but it can solve your problem. It will be like, affordably for you compared to any other alternative. And we will build the functionality that maybe you don't see in this box right now because it's point two something. So our cycle between the first code was written and the first deal we closed on tricky terms, like there was success, like we got paid not all the money up front, of course, for that and so on. But when we entered commercial relationships that were like certain on paper that if we deliver success according to criteria of success, we get paid. It was just 6 months. So it's really hard to believe that an enterprise, you can get there so quickly. But if you really think from the idea that you need this money to validate what you're building, to get investors, team, and so on, then you'd better design your MVP process to be able to sell at the first iteration of your MVP, essentially commercial MVP concept should technically replace MVP concept. Of course, you will go through MVPs to get there through stages, but commercial MVP is much more important than just MVP.
Yeah.
Because typically, I mean, maybe if you're building something innovative to the degree that no one else in the world seen a principle, even like a success in the area that you're achieving. Let's say you're doing, you know, flying car, for instance. Of course, your MVP can be something that just flies, but not doesn't can it take you from A to B. But in the world where of software automation, where pretty much the user experience comes from a combination of many, many factors, and none of them is very, very unique, with some exceptions for AI, let's say, that I can get back to that. You don't need to prove that this works. You need to prove that your product solves client problem. That's what you're trying to prove.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate some of those specific examples. I realize that you guys probably did, you know, 10,000 more different experiments as you were trying to really find that validation in the very early stages, especially in that spectrum. When it comes to, you know, the founding team or the leadership team, as I talk to startups, you know, on a daily basis, and one common denominator that I also see in the successful teams that really separates from the average teams is the ability to really progress through the different specific stages. For example, go from an idea zero to one to build a product, and then go from the product to an execution, where you're actually able to take whatever the existing iteration of the product, execute and deliver that to the market and find some type of validation. Sometimes teams actually do struggle to progress through that life cycle. Maybe tell us a little bit more about the dynamics between you and your co-founders. How did you guys segregate the duties early on? And essentially, what were some of the elements that really helped you shape and build a very cohesive and well-functioning leadership team in the early days?
That's a great question, I think. And quite frankly, for me, when I'm preparing the answer in my head, I'm thinking more like how early days of leadership are different from later, because I feel working with different like Fortune 500 clients in the past, running my own business now at scale, I see that I think that ability to experiment a lot all the time is what really separates like best from not the best. And I think that if you're successful in doing that at early stages, then probably you're successful at scaling that if you don't replace founding team with management team, yeah. Probably. But let me unpack this. So the question is how building that. So I think that the role of the management team in early days a lot is about confidence. You need to exhibit confidence when you're dealing with unknown. Like if, let's say, I was responsible for marketing in early days of the company. You're preparing a campaign. You have 5 people working on that separately. Let's say designers, traffic managers, whatever, building landing pages and so on. No one knows if that would work or not. And you as a leader need to exhibit confidence that it will work. If not, it's still good. We will do 1 more iteration, 2 iterations, 10 iterations, whatever it takes. But we will get to the result when we will see high conversion numbers. If that would not be a trait that a leader of that team exhibits, then at a certain moment, from first iteration never works, at a certain moment people will start depressed because they will see doing and that not working. And that's a comfort. That should be comfort for the whole management team in early days to live in this state of failure every day, still a lot of positive energy, a lot of confidence, but something always should get better from day to day. If that happens, then that's something that you build on. And being able to show that to the team, uh-huh, without being too optimistic. Because if you're too optimistic, like whoever cares about the result, if you say that, you would not get there. You need to say, we care, we're doing our best, we do iteratively. Sorry, maybe today we would not see the success. Mm-hmm. Today we'll see small success in something. We'll understand something better about the world. And it's actually very common to science. You know, one of the reasons I decided not to stay in science, I've seen people trying something for 20, 25 years and not making much progress on some topic, but they're so excited about doing so. And at the same time, some people really like creating a lot, impacting a lot, publishing a lot of articles, getting high Hirsch index and so on. I'm from a family of scientists, and I learned to me still being in the science even is riskier than being a startup founder, because mm-hmm. startup founders, you can easily switch your ideas. Quite frankly, you can do B2B enterprise and in 2 years do a B2C app or dating app. Many founders, they jump from topic to topic.
Yeah,
but you can jump from chemistry to physics in 2 years, maybe in 2030. Mm-hmm. Or you cannot jump between topics in physics. They're so different. There's experimental physics, theoretical physics, and so on. So you kind of have less opportunity to do step left, step right. So short answer to your question, being able to control optimism and at the same time drive this optimism among the team members in a way that allows company to learn more. That's, I think, the core competence.
I've spent a good portion of my career in enterprise myself, in the corporate sector in the States here, working Fortune 100 organizations in the technology spectrum and also in project management and so forth. And one thing that also always stood out to me is the complexity of the sales funnel that flows through the entire, you know, when dealing with enterprise. It's a completely different ballgame if you're working, you know, in D2C or some type of direct-to-consumer type of product. But when dealing with enterprise and B2B sales, completely different ballgame. And one common denominator that always stands out, it's typically the most successful sales teams understand the value of the importance of a top-down approach, where essentially you get some type of access, some type of a relationship with the decision makers and being able to showcase that this is really the problem that maybe you're not really aware of, and this is the solution, how to fix that. Tell us a little bit about that discovery process and how did that really help you guys build out that sales force that you guys currently have that actually works when dealing with complexities of the enterprise sales funnel. What are some of the things to look out for, especially when giving an advice to early stage startups that are trying to penetrate the complexities of the enterprise sales? Maybe share some advice if you were to go back, you know, when you guys were just starting out and talking to some of the decision makers. What were some of the discoveries and lessons learned through that process?
Great question. I think very early, very early in our actually Y Combinator experience, Sergey, our CEO and co-founder, and I, we sat together and we took a training in understanding buyers' personas. And we both had sales experience and enterprise sales experience in the past, but this is the first time when we kind of really thought about there are different stakeholders around each, maybe not each, maybe I'm stepping, making too generalistic statement, but typically when you sell something that interfaces with both business users and technical users, like automation, one develop, other use, you do have multiple buyers. Yes, there is one decision maker, or maybe one champion, but fundamentally they have different pain points. Mm-hmm. I can unpack it for automation case.
Yeah.
Let's take a look at the bank. Bank with 500 employees somewhere, regional, let's say. And they do, let's take two buyer personas, CTO and CEO. And the same problem. Let's say that the problem is using legacy IT stack that is not integrated well, and they spend time on manually creating client accounts. Like you come to a bank and you start creating an account and it takes a lot of time. So for the CEO, the pain point of this is customer service. Like no one wants to go in a bank for 2 hours if they can go and do that online or go to another bank and do it there in 5 minutes. Quality of service. Second one, they pay for all these hours of the manual data entry and copy pasting for the employees. So it's financial inefficiency. That's probably over hiring, maybe even paying over overtimes. For the CTO, the same problem, the same software, the same process. It's being able to deliver solution on time, being able to deliver on budget, being able to deliver with his current team. Because he's in the stage of this pain point where he already has been asked to address the solution, but he doesn't have, but his alternatives are essentially either investing a lot in upgrading the software stack or building custom build code or maybe even apps that will actually amplify the problem in the future. So the same problem, absolutely different motivation, different messaging, different pain points, different thing you're going to talk about when you meet these people. And we need to understand where both of them are in their buyer awareness journey and what's important for them. But even budget questions seem very differently between them.
Yeah.
Even if CEO completely trusts on the CTO in terms of the buying decision here, if CTO is a buyer, it's still like you cannot bypass CEO in this buying process. And I think bigger the company, in automation context, greater the complexity, more stakeholders involved. Then there is a security team involved and many others who are.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And if I was to summarize some of the strategies that you describe, it really boils down to probably empathy and try to be able to put yourself in the shoes of the, you know, the potential user of that particular solution, and also being able to relate on different levels of the type of challenges that these types of users face on daily basis, and clearly articulate how your solution is able to actually fix some of those voids. I think that's a very unique skill set that's ongoing. I would imagine that's something that you guys continuously improve internally at your company. To shift topics a little bit further on the very complex space for every founder, for every CEO, which I would argue with anybody is the most important task for every CEO, is hiring and surrounding yourself with the top talent. And that's a 24/7 job, whether you're actively recruiting or not. Share some of the strategies that really help you through this journey to be able to build a rockstar team, to attract the top talent, and then more importantly, how do you retain the top talent?
Great question. We are, I think, blessed enough that Sergey hired exec team that's still with us, like through all this journey. Pretty much most of the people who lead our all VPs, I think we do have, they are with us for a while. So we definitely know how to retain top talent, but I'm coming back to the time when we hired. Actually, I think it'll be more interesting for if I tell the recent journey. I'm hiring my product team currently mostly in countries of Latin America. Why? Because there are many professionals there. I think it's very underlooked market for talent for US-based companies. Time zone allows you to work together. Technology ecosystem there is booming. Even in small towns, there are talented developers, product people, and so on. Some discipline may be less developed there in terms of like number of professionals with specific background. Let's say customer success, I think, is challenging. But product is not that challenging. So then there is a question, how you as a US company find the best talent and get them? Mm-hmm. So the first one lesson how to do that is proactive position. So don't wait for people to come to you. We live, yes, in remote global world and so on, but they don't know your brand likely unless you are Procter & Gamble or something like that. I mean, okay, there's like Procter & Gamble's of IT world or like Google's and smaller Google's. So if you are a company like ours that has a brand, even in LATAM in terms of our client base and brand in the States for sure, likely most people never heard about you. So you need to reach out to them proactively. LinkedIn is place where I think you should go, because if someone is not on LinkedIn, I will be surprised like to learn that they have very great professional experience. It's just the place where the world connects professionally. You will expect someone who like whom I'm interested in people who led products to new products to market. Uh-huh. So if someone successfully delivered a product to the market and maybe then changed the job at a certain moment of time, they definitely have it on their LinkedIn profile. So it becomes to your proactive position as employer, then you need to engage with them. And of course, the best way to engage is to start talking to them, but you cannot talk to everyone. So you need someone on your team to help you narrow the pool of candidates you want to discuss. That's standard. How do you do that? So you need to be able to speak the same language as your recruiting team does. Recruiters, they hire four different functions. Not necessarily they understand all the nuances between different product roles. Like I'm looking for product owners and product managers who do have more like B2B funnel experience. Someone who can lead new channel creation for a product or can identify a channel for a new product in the market. So we need to create some common language with the recruiter about how this position is different from maybe some other roles. And they need to be able to communicate these to candidates, because we want people who come to talk to our product team and ultimately me from my team to understand whom we are looking for. And we need to validate that they fit. So we create a detailed scorecard with questions that are human-like questions. Not about like how many experiences you have doing so, but how you do things. That's how we expect things to do. Is it something you had experience in the past or not, or want to do? So that allows us to hire globally. We in the past hired in Australia, in India, in many, many countries successfully. And I think now our workforce sits across 25 something countries. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and being an automation company, I would expect nothing less than fully automated, well-documented process when it comes to sourcing, recruiting, interviewing, onboarding, and retaining the top talent at your guys' organization. And that makes a lot of sense what you're talking about. And also, furthermore, what I'm picking up through the conversation is that you also, when you talk about speaking the same language, I would relate on so many levels. Being able to also create that two-way street of a conversation instead of the interview, where you also provide the candidate with an opportunity to ask you questions and make the same determination whether you are a type of leader that they can succeed under. Is this the type of environment and the culture that they can actually cultivate and grow within the organization? So that makes a lot of sense, what you're talking about, the strategies, how to attract and retain top talent. The last portion of every episode on Ivy Podcast, Dmitry, I like to focus on you personally and how maybe strategies that you retain to keep yourself informed on all the things that are going on in your industry or maybe even outside of that, the content diet, so to say. Share some of the sources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself ahead of the curve.
I'd like to give a conventional answer, but really, really, really working for us.
Uh-huh.
Reddit. We read what our clients write about our topic, our domain automation on Reddit.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, managed service providers, our core industry in North America, I'm surprised to see like most companies being there and being there actively. And I've heard it from many vendors who sell to this industry that they see that number of active users on Reddit pretty much matches number of client of potential companies in the States. And whatever people like, Reddit is an interesting place. People can speak there frankly. People hate there any kind of sales and marketing pitches in general. They're very authentic. And ability to read authentic thoughts of your customers or of your potential customers, and they share different technologies there, is quite frankly much more interesting than just to read a digest of technologies and so on. I mean, of course, monitoring competitors, popular places where people write, community forums of different vendors or different online communities. But to me, the most interesting today is reading, kind of listening to the thought process of my clients. Better than that, only talking to them.
Well, yeah, and that's powerful because at the end of the day, if you're able to actually solicit and not only solicit, but also hear what the customer is actually talking about when it comes to maybe not even specifically your product, but just the space in general, that I'm sure it gets you a lot of ideas as the head of product on some of the things that you would need to implement as part of your roadmap. So that makes a lot of sense.
I'd like to provide an example here. For instance, one of the most interesting discoveries I made from Reddit was what really is a bottleneck in ROI for automation?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting topic because in automation, you do typically think about cost of software, cost of developers, cost of maintenance. But in companies where CEO is aware about automation, the major bottleneck is his attention to this topic, surprisingly. Because typically, if you implement automation, you already have paid for the software, you already have the development team. But what they will focus their time on and how much time they will focus on automating something really depends on the C-suite, really depends on the CXO attention to this topic and how what priority automation takes in their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And some people there write that, let's say you plan to sell your business. And when you sell your business before building the valuation, you try to automate as much as possible because suddenly automation became an agenda for a CEO as he prepares the company for being acquired by, let's say, a larger conglomerate. That's to me was so interesting because I always thought about that in terms of resources, but it turns out that C-suite attention or the essentially priority is the major ROI bottleneck. And people frankly share that they're CEOs.
Yeah, no, that's a great example. And I definitely appreciate that. And just overall, Dmitry, I appreciate your time today. It was a very short and insightful conversation that definitely begs for part two, part three, and part four, because I know for a fact that a good portion of our audience are the startup founders and other community that are, you know, in the very early stages where you've been. So I definitely, you know, on their behalf, thank you for some of the insights that you shared, especially from the early days. And what I like doing with, you know, with every episode guests is do a follow-up recording, you know, in about a year at least, to see what everything we've discussed still makes sense, still applies. So I definitely look forward to doing that with you as well.
Yeah. May I just finish on a small note? We just, as we spoke, as we recorded this podcast, we've learned that we have been included in Inc. 5000 this year on a very interesting position for an IT company.
Uh-huh.
We are number 404. We are number 404, fastest growing company in the States. It's very interesting.
That's insane. That's insane. That says a lot, and definitely congrats on that.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.